We begin our morning presentations, and this morning is a toolkit for the Christian journey. We have Joyce Rockwood Hudson, who most of you know, and probably most of you know that she's a writer. I know one of her books was The Book of the Year in Georgia, and many other writings before she even wrote Natural Spirituality for all of us. And she is a key leader of the dream in the church throughout the Southeast and the country, and is a cohort with me and with Susan Sims that we try to work together to promote dream work in the church. Joyce, you're on.
We are here at the beginning of a very exciting week. We are not only embarked on a new week, we are embarked on a new millennium, the third millennium of Christianity. And it is a real question in the culture whether Christianity will be here at the end of this one. Many would say not, that Christianity is on its way out. And I can see why they would say that. The Christianity of the last 1,000 years is no longer compelling enough to hold many of those who are in the vanguard of modern consciousness. And the vanguard of consciousness today is the rank and file consciousness of tomorrow. But some of us in the vanguard have discovered a lost component of Christianity, one that when viewed through a modern lens is amazingly new and exciting and makes Christianity compelling all over again. We do, however, have to learn some things to take on this newly discovered component. We have to put some new tools into the Christian toolkit. Once we have done that, Christianity, in my opinion, is good to go, at least through this century, and I think probably through the whole millennium and beyond. I personally think Christianity will be here forever because I think it actually has the core truth if it can just figure out what it has. So let me try to describe for you what I think a 21st century Christian toolkit should look like. Half of your 21st century Christian toolkit is comprised of the Gospels and the Christian tradition as it has come down to us over the last 2,000 years. Do not even think about throwing out this part of it. This is the masculine side of your spirituality. Now, what does that mean? Basically, the masculine side of spirituality has to do with ideas, ideals, and will. The masculine side of spirituality is a direct product of human consciousness rather than of nature. Although that is not to say that it is not ultimately a part of nature. The masculine spirit does arise out of something that is naturally present in us, but it takes the directed activity of consciousness to bring it to the fore. At the heart of masculine spirituality is faith. And by faith, I do not mean a set of beliefs. I mean a deep and abiding trust that all will be well, no matter what happens. Faith is always naturally present in us, but gaining access to it involves an act of will. We have to use our will to surrender our will and to line up with faith. This is actually the highest use of our will, and is not easy to do. We have to surrender our will to line up with God's will, and it's, as you all know from having tried it, it's not easy. The Christian tradition helps us with this. It provides us handles to grab when we need to remember faith and surrender to it. The tradition keeps our faith muscles strong through ongoing training. It strengthens us with stories of faith, examples for us to remember when we need them. The tradition continually reminds us of the supremacy and the goodness of God, of that greater will to which we have to have the courage to surrender our will. Faith, you should know, is not just a state of mind that makes us feel better and braver. Faith actually opens a safe path for us through the dangers of life. And I say that very confidently. And how do I say it so confidently? It is because it was shown to me in a dream. In fact, I experienced it in a dream. As you will learn as you get into this dream work, to experience something in a dream is to experience it. Jung once said to one of his clients who had dreamt she had been on the moon, he said, then you were on the moon. Don't forget that. Lots of us, that's the only way we get to travel. So it was shown to me in a dream, and to me that means that it was taught to me personally by God, or more specifically by Christ within me. That might sound like an inflated statement, but it is not, because our tradition tells us that Christ dwells within each one of us, and Jesus said that he would send the Paraclete to teach us more than he had taught us, and this is what he was talking about. This is what he was talking about. He does this in our dreams every night if we will listen. And I did listen to this dream, and it was perhaps the most important teaching I have ever received. Now note that the feminine brought me this stronger connection to the masculine part of my spirituality, which is faith. I call this my dream of faith, and I'm going to read it to you so that you can do it with me. It won't be quite as firsthand as it was when I did it, but maybe you can recall it too when you need it. I was driving on a small country road and came to a place where the road crossed an embankment above a low-lying area of wild woods, perhaps an old river channel. The road curved, and for some reason my attention dimmed so that I took the curve, cutting a little too short. My wheels started going off the edge of the pavement, and I knew immediately that the misalignment was too great to correct and that the car was going to go off the road and down the bank. I thought of panicking or somehow fighting the mishap, but it came to me not to do that, but to just accept it in faith, as my father did his final illness, as a friend did when her car rolled and she, though not wearing a seatbelt, emerged unscathed. I thought of what she had told me about that event and let myself relax, feeling that I would have a chance of surviving even a terrible crash into trees if I could be relaxed in body and surrendered to God in spirit. I leaned my head against the steering wheel and closed my eyes. The car began to fall. In my inner vision, on something like a television screen, I could see the many tree trunks in the woods through which I was falling. Then, this image of random trees changed and ordered itself into a mandala-like pattern. The trees aligned like many spokes around a spacious, open center through which I was falling. It was pleasant. I felt just fine falling through such a God-centered pattern of trees, relaxed, unconcerned about what would happen on impact, leaving the outcome to God. After a few moments, though, I began to tense up a bit, my mind going toward the impact, dread beginning to stir. With that, the beautiful ordered pattern began to break up, and the trees became random again, the open center of safety disappearing. I tried to relax again. I wasn't sure I could do it, but I concentrated very hard and managed to get there. The beautiful pattern with the open center came back. I knew I would be all right no matter what happened. Death, injury, no injury. I could accept anything in God's hands. I woke up before coming to the bottom, and on waking, I felt notably peaceful, evidence perhaps that I had truly relaxed. Now, to wake up from a dream in which you're falling and you just feel peaceful was really something. Because of this dream, I myself am now sure that surrendering to the will of God actually rearranges the world. And I do not have to revert to a medieval worldview in order to believe this. It is actually consistent with the proven laws of quantum physics, in which any possible outcome remains possible until it meets consciousness. That's the truth. In quantum physics, any possible outcome, there's a wave of possibility for everything that's happening, and the wave goes from little possibility to great possibility. But it's not until consciousness meets it that it decides where it is. If you take an electron or a very small particle, subatomic particle, and you put it through some kind of something, you don't know where it is until your consciousness meets it. And they can prove this. They can prove that it's just a wave of probability until your consciousness meets it. It rearranges the world. It rearranges the world. And what it is in the dream, the question was, in which consciousness was I going to meet the outcome of my situation? I was able to surrender my ego's consciousness to God's consciousness so that I was then experiencing the world with God's consciousness being the primary one, and that made everything come into order. How was I able, though, to let my consciousness step aside and let God's consciousness take over? The dream was actually full of information about faith, because look what I had to do to get myself into this situation. First, I had to recall the example of my father, and this was a real-world examples I was recalling in the dream. I had to recall the example of my father and the witness of a friend. So I saw my father exercise faith. My friend witnessed to me her moment of faith. And I had to recall those to even start to put myself into the right place to accept this calamity in my life. And then behind that was the training of a lifetime of Christian practice. And even then, it wasn't easy. I really had to work at it. This is why we need the tradition of Christianity. It trains us to live in faith. If we let go of it, we weaken in our ability to hold our faith, and we lose sight of the one God above all in whose service we are meant to live. And the fact is that it would be unwise to go into dream work on such terms as that, because then our understanding of our dreams would be too much in danger of being undermined and subverted to serve the purposes of our frightened and unfaithful ego rather than the purposes of God and our higher self. So we need the tradition to keep a strong hold on our faith, not to mention the strong hold on the tradition's teaching about love. We also need that when we're discerning the meaning of our dreams. So as we appropriate new tools for our 21st century toolkit, we also need to stay in close relationship with the old part of our toolkit, traditional Christianity. Now on to the new part. The new half of the toolkit gives us access to the feminine side of spirituality by arming us with some new concepts and practices. The Western world in general has not yet come to know the feminine side of God's presence in the world. And so, broadly speaking, the church has not yet provided us with this part of the toolkit. But here today, we're working on that, and I can offer you some of the tools, some of the new understandings that many of us now need to have in our possession. Let's start with the understanding that life itself is the feminine side of our existence. When we speak of the feminine, we are speaking of the reality of life. Life comes at two levels, both of which belong to the feminine. There is tangible life, our physical reality, our bodies, our outer world. And there is intangible life, our instincts and drives, our natural reactions, feelings, and impulses. Dreams are a part of life. They are intangible, but they are real. The governing principle of life is an ongoing process of natural growth and transformation. Life that does not grow and transform will die. Life, growth, and transformation characterize the feminine side of our spirituality, as opposed, if you will remember, to the masculine side of ideas, ideals, and will. The concepts developed by Carl Jung for thinking and talking about the inner world are, in my opinion, the best ones for us to use in order to think about and talk about the feminine side of our spirituality. We will start with the two most basic concepts of Jungian psychology, consciousness and the unconscious. Consciousness is everything that we see, perceive, and understand. For each of us, it is what we know, and for each of us, it is different. Consciousness is the realm of the mind. This makes it masculine, symbolically speaking. It is also symbolized by light, by the sun, by images of height, and many other symbols, but those are some of the primary ones. Consciousness is hard work. It makes us tired. We can only do it for about 16 hours at a time. And then we have to fall back into unconsciousness. Think about it. And creatures with less capacity for consciousness than we have, like dogs and cats and baby humans, they can't go for anywhere near 16 hours. Right? Your dog's always lying down and going to sleep. We have very little consciousness when we are born. It builds up gradually during childhood. In earliest childhood, we only achieve little islands of it, which stay with us as disconnected memories. At some point, usually around 5 or so, we begin to have continuous memory. At that point, our consciousness has become solid enough to build upon itself continually. Consciousness is limited. This is one of its primary attributes. It's limited. It can only handle so much at one time. Whatever is present in your awareness right now is conscious. This includes outer physical sensations, what you can see and hear and feel, and it includes your inner world, your thoughts, your feelings, and your intuitions. Everything beyond this is outside your consciousness. So let's be quiet for just a moment and become conscious of our consciousness. Okay, now let's be quiet for a moment longer and think about what we were doing 2 days ago on Saturday. All right, notice how hard that was. Notice how your consciousness had to shift from here and now. Lots of you closed your eyes. I closed my eyes. We had to cut out some of this. Some of you may not have even had time to get to Saturday in the time that I gave you. You could not be fully conscious of right now and 2 days ago at the same time. You had to pull up 2 days ago from the unconscious. It once was conscious. 2 days ago it was conscious. Since then it has fallen into the unconscious. And you had to pull it up from the unconscious into consciousness. And when you did, you had to let some of what's going on right now fall down into the unconscious. Consciousness is limited. It can only hold so much. But, be that as it may, it is very important. Consciousness is the dry land beneath our feet as we live our human life. It is our known world. And the more consciousness we have, the more fully human we become. You never do get to where you can hold a whole lot at one time in consciousness, but you get to where you can access it pretty quickly from down in the unconscious. So the more you have there to pull up quickly into consciousness, then the more fully human you are, the more you have ever come to realize, which may then fall down into the personal unconscious, the more human you are, because you can get back to that, you can bring it back up. The center of consciousness is the ego. We need a strong ego in order to keep our consciousness ordered and intact. Never dump on the ego. A lot of people want to get rid of the ego. You need the ego. Without the ego, you are crazy. It's true. You lose your ego, they send you off. As much as the ego, as the center of consciousness, would like to think that consciousness is all there is of reality, the fact is that consciousness is just a little island in the vast, endless sea of the unconscious. Because the unconscious, after all, is everything that is not conscious. It is everything that is unknown, not only in the present, but in the past and in the future. So the unconscious is humongous. Consciousness is really small, and it's very helpful to think of it as a little island in a big sea. The unconscious is symbolized or vaguely intuited as being somehow below us or around us or inside us. It is unseen, unknown, and hidden, but it is always interacting with us. The unconscious is not nothing. It lives. Just as consciousness has a center, which is the ego, so too does the unconscious have a center. The center of the unconscious is the self, with a capital S. That term comes to us from Carl Jung. We can call it other things. We can call it the God center within. A member of our dream group has begun to call it our God nature, a term that I like a lot. But for now, to keep us on the same page, we will stick with Jung's label, which is the self. The self is a truly awesome reality. It coordinates our many parts as well as the many parts of life itself. It directs our journey. It teaches us, guides us, and heals us. The self is symbolized by mandala forms, such as a circle with a cross in it. There are many symbols for the self, but the circle with the cross in it is a kind of preeminent symbol of the self. And for us Westerners, it is symbolized by the Christ. The self and the Christ are the same. The historical man Jesus carries for us Christians an image of the Christ or the self. Jesus revealed the self to us and showed us how to connect to it in our own lives. His life gave us an example of how to live in full consciousness of the self. And again, let me remind you of the other names for this center of consciousness. It is the God center within us. It is our God nature. The unconscious itself belongs to the realm of nature. It's natural history on the inside. I had a dream once that said, I was in Washington at the Smithsonian, and it says, you have been given the key to the natural history building, but that doesn't mean that you know everything. From that, I knew it was saying that I have learned about the unconscious and I have learned about natural history. That has given me the key to the natural history building. So the unconscious belongs to the realm of nature. It is a part of life and it follows natural laws. It just flat out does. It is feminine in a symbolic sense because it's nature. Other common symbols of the unconscious are water in all its forms, forest and wilderness, and underground places. There are many other symbols of the unconscious, but those are very common ones. So when you dream of water, which you are likely to do while you are here, and especially if this is new to you, you will almost guarantee 100%, 95% guarantee that you will dream of water. If this is new to you, you will be dreaming of water at this conference. And what that is you are dreaming of learning about the unconscious. This will also be the case if you dream of wild places or basements or caves or other things like that. Basements are down, caves are inside. The unconscious has three important attributes. First of all, it is autonomous. We do not have control over the unconscious. It messes with us. It relates to us on its own, for good or for ill. The ill is when we're not relating back, makes it seem bad. Second, the unconscious seeks dialogue with us. It wants a back and forth exchange. Its attempt at dialogue is unceasing, whether we know about it and pay attention to it or not. Life goes much better if we do become aware of it. There is a major theme in Christianity that goes something like this: wake up, know Jesus, and be saved. There are many levels to this awakening. At a deep level, it is an awakening to the autonomous dialogue that is always coming toward us from the unconscious through the unfolding of life, both within us and outside us in the world around us. The third important attribute of consciousness is that it is compensatory. The reason it seeks dialogue with us is to balance and expand our consciousness. This is an attribute of nature which constantly seeks to balance her many systems. So the unconscious does not try to tell us what we already know. Rather, it seeks to fill in our gaps in consciousness. It tries to give us a balanced and whole picture with which to operate as we live our lives. Well, this sounds good. Why is it then that we are not more tuned into this dialogue than we are? Especially considering that it is our God nature, the Christ, who is trying to talk to us. And it has been 2,000 years for us to get onto this. The primary reason that we resist tuning in to this greatly valuable dialogue is that we are afraid of our shadow. Our shadow is made up of the parts of ourselves, good and bad, that we don't know about and that we don't want to know about. Good and bad. Anything we don't know is, by definition, not conscious, which means that it is unconscious, which means that our shadow lives in the unconscious. We all have unconscious shadow stuff on which the light of our consciousness has yet to shine. I've got it, you've got it, still. No matter how much work you've done, you've got more. This means that if we turn our face to the unconscious and engage in dialogue with it, we will meet our shadow. In fact, it's really the first thing at the door when you open it. And universally, as human beings, we do not want to do that. Now, why not? I mean, we really all do not want to meet our shadow. Universally, nobody wants to do that. You might say, oh, yes, I do. But something in you say, no, no, we don't. Because anytime we become conscious of a part of ourselves that has been in shadow, we then have to take responsibility for it. We have to handle it. We have to integrate it. We have to change. And ego consciousness really, really doesn't like to change. Now, why is that? It is not because the ego is perverse. It is because change always feels like death to the ego. And this is because of the limitation of consciousness. Because remember that the ego is the center of consciousness only. It only knows what's on the island. It doesn't have the big picture that the self has. So this, again, is why we need faith to take the inner journey. We need it for the sake of our egos, so that our ego can have the courage to face the unconscious and meet the shadow and undergo change after change that feels like death. Feel sorry for your ego. I can actually sometimes be over in my self side saying to my ego, I'm sorry, honey, this is just the way it's going to have to be. You're just going to have to hold on and we'll be okay. But I can be in my self side, but my ego side is always there. And so at that point, I'm too. I can't get rid of her and I can't make her shape up. Our ego's natural tendency then is to avoid dialogue with the unconscious. And that tendency is called resistance. We all have it. Even the most willing of us have resistance. And to some degree, we have to put up with resistance because our ego needs it in order to be able to move at its own pace and take on change only when it is ready, when it is strong enough. But to some degree, we also have to learn to recognize the symptoms of resistance and call ourselves on it and push past it to the new life that awaits us on the other side of the next change. When the dialogue between consciousness and the unconscious is successfully engaged, we experience symbolically the union of opposites, the union of the masculine and feminine energies of human and divine life. The fruit of this union is individuation. What that means is that we break out of the collective definition of ourselves. We put down the collective measure and allow ourselves to grow into the unique individual each of us was born to be. Last night when they were talking about Dante and he was exiled, they said at first he tried to get together with some other exiles and do this collective thing of how can we get back there, and finally he realized, no, he was going to have to go an individual path and find an individual answer to his individual life. This is never easy and it is never fun. It means breaking away from the herd. It means that I, as an individual, stand alone in the various solutions to my life that gradually appear from the dialogue between consciousness and the unconscious. I have to accept these individual solutions to my life problems without any validation for them from the collective culture, which cannot validate them for me because it only carries a collective understanding of how life should be lived. Even in a group like this, we can give you tools for your individuation journey, but even here, the answers that you find for the individual problems in your life cannot be validated by the answers that other people around you are finding for their individual problems. And that's the problem with individuation, is it's so lonely. So I have to move alone into the new life into which individuation leads me. Later, after the new life is in place, it feels good. and the collective seems to appreciate the gifts that it brings, even though it was not very encouraging to bring it in. But when it is in the process of coming to birth, it feels terrible. But isn't that the inescapable reality of birth? It always comes with pain. Our feminine side knows all about this. Individuation means growing into wholeness. It means becoming the person God created us to be. It means growing into our Christ self, incarnating God more fully in our own beings through our dialogue with the unconscious. As we learn to follow God's instructions and guidance more closely, our lives begin to exert a more positive effect on the world around us, and we feel more fulfilled and at peace. So how do we engage in this dialogue with the unconscious? The two primary ways in which the dialogue naturally takes place are through dreams and synchronicity. Dreams come to us while we sleep, and synchronicity comes while we are awake. And let's look first at synchronicity. This is a dream conference, but it should almost be a dream and synchronicity conference because those are really the two parts of the daily walk. Synchronicity is meaningful coincidence. It is difficult for the modern rational mind to acknowledge the reality of synchronicity, even though it too fits quite well with quantum physics. But then the modern rational mind also has a hard time coming to grips with quantum physics, which is the physics, as I said before, of subatomic particles. Physical laws in the subatomic world are not the same as in the macro world. There's a different law of motion and all kinds of stuff in the subatomic world than there is in this world that our awareness is in, which still goes by the Newtonian laws of classical physics. Physicists refer to the physical laws of subatomic particles as quantum weirdness. They freely admit that they do not understand the underlying reality that is demonstrated by these laws. They're working really hard right now to try to figure it out. But as long as they keep consciousness out of the picture, they're not going to figure it out. But that doesn't stop them from making use of these laws for all kinds of modern technology. Most of the modern technology that's come up in the last 50 years has been based on quantum physics. So quantum physics is true, it's just not understood. They know how to work the math, but they don't know why it is that a particle can go through two slits at one time, can be in two places at one time because its probability wave is going through two places at one time. That boggles their mind, and lots of physicists try not to think about it. Really, that's really true. So synchronicity, too, seems weird until you get used to it. And by synchronicity, I do hope you know what I'm saying. Meaningful coincidence, things that happen that have meaning that other people would say that's a coincidence, but you say, no, that's God talking to me. By nature, women tend to be more aware of synchronicity than men are. Although, once a man gets onto it, he's got it. So it is not that men are less capable of it, it's just that they are less open to the idea of it to begin with. This has to do with focused masculine consciousness, and it's okay. We love them anyway. Women always bring the new ideas into the world because the men are so devoted to their ideas. Remember that the masculine is ideas, ideals, and will. And so men are much more devoted to ideas than women are. Women will put down an idea when life seems to ask her to, whereas men will continue to hold that idea as long as they possibly can. And that's their job. So we want them to do that, but not forever. The synchronicity goes on all the time, but it is usually unnoticed. However, most people have noticed it around a death or when falling in love, two times when synchronicity kicks into high gear. This is because, among other reasons, I suppose this isn't the only reason, but these are times when consciousness is particularly shaken and knocked back. And this lets the unconscious come more into the foreground. It is kind of like when an eclipse lets us see stars in the daytime. Synchronicity makes meaning out of the coincidence of ordinary events. For example, you might be thinking about an old friend you've not seen for a long time, and the phone rings, and it is that friend. Or you dream about an old friend, and the next day the phone rings, and it is that friend. Or you're having some kind of problem in life and you're walking through the bookstore and a book falls off the shelf at your feet and you pick it up and it's the book that you need. It's the book that has some information that is going to help you. It is important to note that the book did not fall off the shelf by magic. There was a physical cause, some real way in Newtonian physics that got the book into the unstable place that it was and something that set off the fall, but the synchronicity, the quantum effect was in the timing. Synchronicity arises from and gives testimony to the great orchestration of life and being. Synchronicity shows us that life itself is the process of God and that our dialogue with God never stops. The trick with synchronicity is to give it the right weight in our lives, not too much and not too little. If we give synchronicity too much attention, it makes us crazy. It does. In the extreme form, you're schizophrenic. If you give it too little attention, you miss its valuable guidance. At a gathering like this one, in which we are living day and night with a heightened awareness of the unconscious, synchronicity gathers energy and becomes much more noticeable. So pay attention. You will experience it in the days ahead. And synchronicity is just as important to your journey as dreams are. Dreams are the richest component of feminine spirituality, the most complex, the most informative, the most voluminous. Our dreams never stop. They keep coming night after night. How do we approach them? First of all, we have to remember them. We dream every night, but we do not remember our dreams every morning. There are things we can do, however, to increase our dream recall. Turning attention to the dream world definitely helps. Coming to this conference will prime your dream pump. It probably already has. So will reading about dreams and the unconscious after you go home. So you can keep this effect going by keeping your attention turned toward this world to some degree. And joining a dream group at home is one of the best ways to ensure that your dream life will not fade out after this conference is over. By taking up such activities, you withdraw some of the energy that has been going into consciousness and invest it instead in the unconscious. This strengthens the unconscious in the economy of your psyche. Think of it as taking from the rich and giving to the poor. No kidding, this has a lot to do, I think, with the basic Christian admonition to feed the poor, to take care of the poor. The poor inside your own psyche. Psychic energy is symbolized by money. You dream money, and you've got, no doubt, some personal associations with money that would expand the symbolism, but the archetypal association with money is psychic energy. So you need to remember you're poor. Once we begin to remember our dreams, we have to write them down. This takes time. It is a discipline. But if we don't write them down, we lose many of the details, and sometimes we lose the whole dream itself. Once we have recorded a dream, we have to analyze it, which we're not going to go into here because we're going to spend the whole rest of the conference on that. So instead, I'm going to just give you some general characteristics of dreams. First of all, dreams are truthful. They do not lie. Your interpretation might be off, but the dream itself always speaks truly if only you can understand it. Dreams come in the service of health and wholeness. They do not come to mess you up, and they do not come to do you harm. Even the scariest dream is trying to get your attention for a good reason. Dreams are seldom literal. The language of the unconscious is symbolic and metaphorical. Jesus used this language when he told parables. Dreams are like parables. And in interpreting your dream parable, it is important to keep in mind that everything in the dream belongs to the dreamer. Your brother Joe is seldom your brother Joe in the context of the dream. He is a part of you. So the question is, what do you associate with Joe? Listen to your answers to that question. The Joe energy in your dream is referring to that part of you. There is, however, always a question of inner meaning versus outer meaning in dream interpretation. Dreams do have many levels, and usually both outer and inner. I have noticed that introverts tend, this is not what you would think, introverts tend to emphasize the outer meaning, because that's their missing realm. So they're hoping that their dreams are saying something about outer life, while extroverts tend to do the opposite, and they tend to emphasize inner meaning. The extroverts in the group are always saying, no, you got to turn it inside yourself. And I'm saying, I think about the inside of myself all the time. I want to think about the outside of myself. It is okay to have either the one slant or the other, but both inner and outer interpretations always need to be considered. It is another general characteristic of dreams that if a dream is not telling you something new, that usually means that you are not interpreting it correctly. So after you have made an interpretation of your dream, stop and ask yourself. This is always important. Stop and ask yourself, did I already know that, or think that, or feel that way? If the answer is yes, it probably means that your work is not over and you need to dig deeper. But if, after trying to dig deeper, you still don't understand the meaning of your dream, don't worry, you will get the message again in another dream. And if you misinterpret a dream, future dreams will correct it. So you don't even have to worry too much about misinterpreting dreams. We all misinterpret dreams every day. We always misinterpret our dreams a little bit, but further information comes and clears up any of our mistakes. Dreams build on each other. They gradually bring in a new understanding using images and themes that are repeated over a period of time. And the elements in the themes will gradually change as these themes keep showing. You hope they are gradually changing because that means you're learning about them. And you can watch the progress of your own growing consciousness by noting the changes in the elements of a repeated theme. Finally, let me close by saying that the best way to work with dreams over a long period of time is to join a dream group. A dream group keeps you focused and on task. If you are in a dream group, you know you have to come up with at least one dream a week. That's true. It's true that many a Saturday night I go to bed saying, okay, I got to have a dream for tomorrow, and I'll get one. Without this constant reminder, you might well get busy with outer life and let your dream life slide away. Another invaluable benefit of a dream group is that participation in group dream interpretation greatly hones your skills in interpreting your own dreams by yourself. The best context for a dream group is a church or a similar faith community with a firm foundation in religious tradition. This provides the God focus and the needed balance of masculine spirituality. We will talk about dream groups, how to start them, and how to keep them going in churches in a later session here on Wednesday morning. But for now, you have in your toolkit some bright, shiny new tools to help you do the work of this conference, and you'll have plenty of opportunities to try them out.